From WUFTFM, this is Animal Airwaves Live, our weekly hour-long program devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. I'm so glad you could tune in today, and I'm so happy to welcome back to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Michael Walsh. And we're going to be talking about manatees today. Now, you may recall that we talked about manatees on this program recently, but my understanding is that we are having now in Florida here in 2021, and maybe even at the tail end of 2020, an unusual mortality event. And Dr. Walsh is here to talk with me about that today. And so welcome back to the program, Dr. Walsh. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be back.
Now, am I correct in sort of my preface there describing the timing of this unusual mortality event? It is underway right now, but did it begin last year?
Yes, it did. Actually, a number of weeks before January 1st, in fact, a couple of months, they noticed that there were some issues with the animals that were gathering in the Indian River Lagoon and finding animals that were dying that were coming in a state of health that was very poor, extremely thin in many cases. And so that initiated some initial investigations and evaluations, because you never know what's going on at that point. That can result from a number of different causes, but as the frequency of the animals presenting in these poor nutritional states kept growing, that's when they started looking at there was probably some kind of environmental impact as a result of a lack of enough seagrass for these individuals to be able to maintain themselves, much less get through a winter.
Let's talk geography for just a bit, because Florida is a big state. Where is this unusual mortality event occurring primarily?
Well, if you look at the way Florida is set up, and you can also look at it by the way FWC divides it, they have different regions that they divide the state into. So you're going to have a northeast region, a central east region, and a southeast region. Now, the area where this is occurring is within the Indian River Lagoon, which is basically a almost closed system, a body of water that exists between the mainland of Florida and the outer islands that form the outer wall of the system. There are a few places where water does exchange, but in reality, it's fairly closed in many of those aspects. So you have a closed environment that's been under a lot of stress for decades, really, in terms of how we've been treating it. And that timeline has led to a slow deterioration of the environment, although it would be fast by some people's feelings. And now we've hit a point where we've gotten into a tipping level to where you generally can't even have enough food there to support those animals, because the manatee is coming back to Florida during the winter. They're coming to what they consider their warm water sites. Some of those are historic when you look at springs. Others are man-made when you look at power plants. But when generations of manatees have been raised by the power plants, that means they also gather at different sections instead of going as far south as they can, or a number of them heading to the springs that they have a historic relationship to.
Right. Now, it is going to be fairly understandable why manatees would come to Florida during the wintertime, because the water here would be warmer than it might be in some of the other places to which they are welcome to go in the summer, when water is pretty much warm everywhere. And the voyages that they make here to Florida can take them quite a while to make, but they get here and they're looking for safe places to find the food that they need to make it through the winter. But what it sounds like is that these are vulnerable animals because they rely so much on the environment in which they are living. I mean, this makes a lot of sense. And any kind of disruption to their access to adequate food can create, understandably, a dire situation for them. Is that primarily what this is? Is this a lack of food resources during this unusual mortality event?
Yes, I think that's where people are leaning, based on knowing that FWC and some other groups have, USGS, which is U.S. Geological Service, have studied the food aspects, the seagrasses, for many, many years. Sea turtles and manatees are going to depend on that for a direct nutritional input. The interesting thing about it is it's not just those that are affected when something like this is happening, because those seagrasses are also a place for other small developing animals to be able to hide and to have their lifestyle. So when you take away the cover for the small fish, then you start affecting the big fish, which means down the road you can affect the dolphins or any other species. It depends on the fish. And you affect the livelihood of the fishermen in that area. So over time, they've been seeing the numbers of fish that they could catch in bulk go down and down and down. As far back, and it isn't that far, even in 2013, it was already being noticed that manatees were having difficulty finding enough food, so they were switching to other food sources. So when you think of seagrass like a giant blade of grass that you would think of from your lawn, you've also got to think in terms of there's a lot of different algaes out there. Not all algaes are bad, but some of those algaes can be fairly big, long, and sea turtles like those macroalgaes, the larger algaes. Manatees eat some of them as well. So when they started seeing that there was not a lot of seagrass, even in 2013, manatees were known to be shifting to the algaes as a secondary source. And that actually had a die-off going on at that point, which is partially figured out and was pretty amazing in terms of FWC figuring out that there may be that effect between switching your diet. Like if you switch your diet and you're not used to what you're eating, you end up with GI upset. You may take in microorganisms that your body's not used to. That can shift your whole relationship to digestion and potentially result in animals dying from being on the wrong food. Now it's at a point where even the macroalgaes are being overgrazed, which then stresses the sea turtles. So a few facilities may be seeing more sea turtles because all you have to do with the sea turtles is sort of the same thing. They can exist fantastically when you've got normal temperatures. The wintertime is a stressful environment. It's meant to be short. It's meant to be something you get through and get by on. But if you shift something else, like you were saying, if you tip the amount of food available downward, if the cold becomes excessive and too long, those things then work in a combination to put the animals into a tipping point, and that's what you've been seeing here.
So in a typical year, calendar year or what have you, how many manatee deaths might be reported to FWC in a given year?
Well, if you look at the last 5 years as an example, and this is not taking into account some other natural problems we can touch on, let's say like from 2016, 2020, you are losing between 205 animals per year, and I think the high point for those 5 years was 2018 with 299 animals. This year, we're already up to 696. And of those 696, about 625 of those have come from this Atlantic Management Unit, which is composed of those three regions that include the Indian River Lagoon. So in just 4 months, and that doesn't count the time beforehand, we've already gotten 625 animals dying, where normally you might see a tenth of the 200. So it's really out of balance at this point.
Okay, so in a normal year, we're in the range of 200 and something animals.
Correct.
We could be on pace to be 10 times that this year, over 2,000 animals.
I guess it's possible. Now, what doesn't necessarily lend to making that change in numbers is that part of what happens with this is that they're limited where they will go, where they can go by the warm water or the warmer water or these sites. You may get in a really bad cold year, 1,500 animals just sitting at one of these power plants, waiting for the sun to come up, for them to get hungry. They'll go out and feed for a little bit. They'll come back to the warm water. So when the winter's over for the most part, and now the water is warming north of here along the Gulf and along the East Coast, you're seeing some of these guys disperse, which is what they will do. They'll start seeking out other sources, just like a wild herd of antelope would seek out another pasture when that pasture has been overgrazed. They're moving now. In fact, they found a couple of animals in the Georgia area that fit the same type of description that these thinner animals are.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm talking to you here on Thursday, April 29th. I mean, it's about to be May, which means that up the East Coast, water's getting warmer, the habitat's becoming more welcoming, let's say, to these animals who would not want to be somewhere cold? Well, the water's going to be warming up as the days get longer and the sun is sort of higher in the sky and more photons are kind of hitting the water and warming that up. So we've got an environment that could be better for the animals to kind of get out of these places that are maybe putting them under a lot of stress. As you mentioned, the sort of Indian River area in Florida, they might be moving on to greener pastures, so to speak, which would mean that these numbers that you're saying, I mean, it's over 600 animals so far, well, maybe we have kind of reached or passed the worst part of this unusual mortality event?
Well, that's the hope. In some of the regions, the reports of carcasses of these dead manatees has remained slowed, for instance, in the southeast. And if you look at the eastern central region, it's about the same. The northeast region was still elevated as of a few weeks ago. So you're seeing some things that potentially give indicators, and the hope is that this will slow down and hopefully abate. The problem is going to be we're still stuck with the same problem. If we've been having problems with seagrass for decades and it's going through these very difficult times, there may not be enough when they come back from next winter to avoid this reoccurring. So that's where there is a great deal of effort going on to try to figure out, okay, we understand the problem better. We haven't done our job in taking care of the problem. It's time to do something to approach it and mitigate it if at all possible. And when you look at what can be done, it really depends on how the environment is, because what got you into trouble in this environment is we've changed the water quality. Seagrass is just like if you take a plant into your house that requires a certain amount of sunlight and you sit it into the middle of the room where it doesn't get that sunlight, it is not going to grow well. It's not going to produce the leaves necessary. It'll be stunted and it may not survive. You may still be giving it water, but if it doesn't have the sunlight, then you're not giving it the basic components it has to have to survive and grow. So if we allow the water quality to still stay bad, so let's say when we say poor water quality, we're looking at the idea that how much sunlight can actually get through the water surface down to the grass. If you allow things like algal blooms to take place, if you end up with a lot of material in the water column that blocks that sunlight, then you get into the same issue of that as that plant in your house to where it cannot get enough to grow. So the manatee comes in, hundreds and hundreds of them in a region, and grazes that, but it can't respond like it should in a pasture and grow. What you usually have is when they move out, that's like you putting your horses on a different part of your pasture. You give time for the pasture to recover. But if you don't fertilize that pasture, if you allow the weeds to take it over, when those horses come back, you have not restored what's necessary for their optimal health. So the goal in this is to also take a look at what originally started this problem and what really influenced even back in the 2000s to where we had these algal blooms that are occurring as a result of a lot of different factors, but you put too many nutrients in the water, you've got runoff from the shoreline. You change the water naturally in the Indian River Lagoon during the summer rainy season, so it shifts from a higher salinity to a lower salinity. You've got to have enough plant capability to take into account the natural factors that might shift and that we've already influenced. Now you throw water that doesn't let the sunlight through and the grass doesn't respond as well. So that's the big challenge, is we've got to look at cleaning up the environmental relationships in order to allow the grasses to produce at a rate that can provide the food for the fish and the turtles and the manatees.
This is absolutely fascinating, Dr. Walsh. What I want you to do, if you will, is hold tight. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about what can be done, and in particular, you know, how we can create a better environment for these manatees, because when they come back next year, we don't want to be in the same position that we are right now. So we're going to take a short break. I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Michael Walsh. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Michael Walsh. And we're talking today about manatees again. But this topic is especially fascinating. And before we left off, Dr. Walsh, we had been talking about the kind of degraded environment here in parts of Florida in which the manatees are not having access to adequate food. And it occurs to me that a couple things are a given here. One, we cannot, over the course of the summer and fall, send out a memo to all manatees to say, listen, it's probably not a good time to go back to Florida next winter because we may still have this compromised situation vis-a-vis the food environment. I mean, it's not like they're checking their Facebook for, you know, posts about it. So they're going to be coming here probably regardless. What could possibly be done in the short span of a year to mitigate some of the factors that have been causing these manatees to be under so much food stress?
Well, that's a good question from the standpoint of I'm not an expert in that area. What they're looking towards is a multi-level approach. You need to prevent any more issues with algal blooms and any further deterioration in the Indian River Lagoon water quality. The other aspect is how can you look at what we can do in terms of replacing those grasses? If you don't have improved water quality, then you're going to be stumped in terms of getting the response you need, and you may not get the return of the grasses at a level that can still make that environment where it was before. And those grasses are also helpful in maintaining that balance in the water, not only being affected by it. There has been some amazing work done on the West Coast in terms of where seagrass has been lost over time. Sometimes other factors can affect this. You can have changes in what's called the turbidity, and turbidity is really a measurement of how much material is in the water column that blocks that sunlight. So if you have a high turbidity, that means when you look down into that water, it's cloudy. There's material there that is blocking your vision. If you have otherwise good turbidity, which is a low turbidity level, and you can get grasses back into the environment, you can potentially reseed some areas. They've done that on the West Coast. There's a group called Sea and Shoreline, an aquatic restoration group that's been involved in a very large project on the West Coast. And that's involved things like Kings Bay, Cedar Key, where they've gone in with grass that they have raised and replanted it. It takes a lot of effort because part of what happens in an environment over time, especially when we seem to be involved, is it deteriorates. You got to go in and pull the muck out that isn't going to support the grasses, replant the grasses. And the grass that they have over there has done amazingly well. So there's a lot of people hoping, well, can we do the same thing on the East Coast? It's a little different. There's some other challenges, partially based on what the environment is doing at this stage, what grasses are natural, which ones will do well, which ones can tolerate the changes in the salinity of the water, and how do you protect them if a couple thousand or more manatees suddenly show up and are going to just denude anything you put in there. So you've got a lot of big challenges, but this company was extremely successful in the West Coast, and they're involved in some of the research in terms of trying to see how could we apply these same techniques we did on the West Coast to the East Coast. So they have some plots that they're working with, trying to see how that's going. In fact, we're working with them on a couple of projects. We're hoping to get some seagrasses from them so we can look at those seagrasses that they raise as a control for what might be involved in holding back the seagrass in the wild. So you can analyze these home-raised seagrasses and say, okay, we know that they have this or that in them and they should not have this or that in them. And now we can go to the wild and say, okay, when we analyze the wild seagrasses, they've taken up toxins, they've taken up contaminants and things that we allow to get into the water column that we may use on our lawns and other stuff. We'll have a better feel for what's challenging the seagrass in addition to the water quality and in addition to the fact that we just can't get the effort behind it right now. It sounds like there's been some movement in the legislature to potentially throw, I wouldn't say throw, put some funding into where we can approach this. And so there may be some good news coming across on that aspect. And if the people who are trying the planting capability are successful, there may be ways to do that, but it won't be an easy thing to do without cleaning up the environment at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like though this problem has appeared to come on suddenly, that is to say, a few years ago, you had, you know, circa 200 and something manatee deaths per year, and now we're at over 600, and it's only, you know, not even May 1st yet. Well, that is kind of an alarming and shocking escalation of the problem. One assumes that you can't just turn it around right away. If things were to be this bad next year, and we hope that they won't, how bad would that be ultimately for manatees of the, you know, of the time of the type that live here in, you know, the Southeast United States? As a species, do we have enough individuals to kind of weather a mortality event like this for, say, 2 years or maybe three or more?
I think that's a really interesting question. I'm probably not informed enough to speculate that way, and I don't think anybody really wants to speculate that way, partially because we hope to be able to at least do some mitigation, or they hope to be able to do some mitigation. What you're saying is logical. It could be a recurrent problem. What's challenging for the animals that are still alive but very thin is that during the time that these individuals may die, and in many cases, it's moms that are dying, and they're orphaning calves, which there are more calves right now that have been orphaned than have been seen before. Those ones that survive are going to not have enough nutritional support to be able to keep reproducing probably this next year. You'll find in most species, including ours, if you are at such a stage of weight loss to emaciation, your reproductive system is not going to be functional until you get back to a stage of health to where you can put the energy into reproduction. So you could see a decrease in the number of animals that reproduce, at least from this population. The others will probably be very similar as long as they're not going through similar things. So you're not only affecting the feeding aspect possibly next year, but you've affected the reproductive relationship down the road for probably a year and maybe more if it turns out that we end up with this chronic thinner animal issue to where they have to take the whole summer just to get back to any kind of a marginal health, and then they go back into the same problem. What normally tends to occur is that the animals put on a bunch of weight during this summer and fall, just like we would if we were still living outside. You're going to eat the fattier foods. You're going to put as much weight on as possible. It's why we have fat cells, was to get through these same kind of periods. But if you go into that period in a poor nutritional state, your body condition is lower, you are more likely to succumb to the problem that second year because you just don't have the resources built into your fat system to get you through that. And that's the whole goal for the normal years, is get through the 3 to 4 months that are the worst, rebuild yourself, reproduce, and then you're going to potentially, hopefully, have a couple of good years with very little cold. And you might be able to then get by that year and the next year and the next year. But if you have recurrent years of either poor food availability or too much cold, then those factors all start to pile up on top of each other and fewer animals can make it through.
With the understanding that the goal would be to have a more suitable habitat for these animals, what else are people willing to do to ease the strain on manatees? It sounds to me like some of these animals might need rehabilitation.
Definitely. There have been animals taken in for rehabilitation as a result of this. You're probably not seeing the numbers of animals that could be rehabilitated because they're in such poor shape. A lot of them have died. I think back in around April 19th, they had recorded that there had been 60 rescues. Now, again, when we throw out these really high numbers, that's all causes. So there were 60 rescues of all causes in the same region, but there was a higher percentage of thin animals and orphans because they lost their moms. Because the mom is going to keep that baby going as long as she possibly can. She's not going to necessarily stop feeding it. It will get to the point where her physical condition will deteriorate to where she can no longer make milk. She's probably going to be close to expiring when she gets to that point. The calf will probably already be thin. They're going to be a challenge as well. But it really still goes back to how are we going to turn this around when you look at the historical perspective. There are organizations out there who are also involved in trying to mitigate the IRL issues. But when you talk to, you know, people about the timeline, there was a super bloom of algae back in like 2011. And that was followed by a brown tide, which is another algal bloom in 2012, 2013. And that's what set them up for the initial problems where manatees started seeking other food sources. So not that long ago, we already had lost potentially 50 to 55% of the seagrasses. As a result of what's been going on, some people are estimating we could be as low as 10 to 15% of what's there. That's hard to bring back in a timeline that's going to benefit the manatee for next year. So what people outside of these organizations can do is to realize you can't allow things like fertilizer to get into there and feed the algae. That's what classically happens. And this isn't just a marine problem. I've worked with some ponds on land, and let's say you go out and you fertilize your pasture and it rains really hard, that drains into the pond, you'll get a harmful algal bloom in some cases in those freshwater ponds, which will kill the birds and anything that gets in there and drinks that material. There are toxins even in freshwater systems that go through the same type of thing. Mother Nature meant this to be in a balance. And then when we throw nutrients in there from a lot of different reasons, whether it's from septic tanks, from runoff, from lawns, from cities, that throws it out of balance and allows things that love the extra nutrition to overtake the water column and to starve off the stuff that should be there.
Yeah, I mean, so this really points to the responsibility that we have as Floridians and as homeowners, for instance, or, you know, businesses, to be more ecologically conscious. And this may be outside of your area of expertise, but what are some simple things that we can do to reduce the harmful effects on the water around Florida that will allow manatees to do better because they will have better access to food?
Well, again, I'm not an expert in this area. A lot of it's just the logic of what would occur in any kind of system where you've added material that puts that system into an imbalance. So you're looking at trying to control any kind of sewage or material that goes into the water system that might feed those other organisms. You're looking at trying to decrease the amount of fertilizer that might get into these areas. If you fertilize upstream in some of the rivers and the timing is, let's say, not ideal. You get heavy rains that washes into the river, that washes back into the Indian River Lagoon as well. So you can have these focal points where things are coming into the system. You can have wider areas, runoff from the streets. You see, you'll be, I'm sure, familiar with these things when you're near water bodies, and you'll have maybe a little ceramic sticker in the concrete that basically tries to get you don't wash anything down into the sewer systems that run into the water bodies, because that feeds the problem. That's grass clippings and other things, anything like that. Grass, when you clip it, becomes the food for the next growth phase of the grass. But when you take it off of the grass and you end up with it in these storm drains that feed into the water system, that becomes a source of nutrients. A lot of people think that septic tanks tend to be more likely to leak materials through the areas that they're buried in into these water systems. So that's why you hear concerns about septic tanks. And so all these different approaches, or whether it's putting water into the Indian River Lagoon that may be draining from other water bodies, which was seen a few years ago in terms of water from Okeechobee that gets put into the east or the west coast, also carrying more nutrients, can start these blooms off. And when that material dies, even after the bloom, it becomes a problem in terms of it chokes off the life below it. It sometimes actually consumes all the oxygen in the area as well. So you'll end up with these dead zones where literally nothing can live, and it'll just look like a black area. And I dove on the West Coast in the past, and you can see these dead zones. So a lot of it is up to us. A lot of it is up to agencies. I think kudos have to go to FWC and to the U.S. Geological Service and to some of the other groups that are working with the Indian River Lagoon to try to show what the problem is. Because really what science does is it gives us some guidelines into how we can look at things. So when you think of the steps you can take, you're really looking at a mission statement or a philosophy of how science functions, which is to investigate, understand, educate, guide, mitigate, and then ideally prevent. And we're at a stage now where we need to prevent.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's such a complex issue. And of course, it, like many things, will sometimes come down to politics, because let us say that science were to investigate and really be able to make a convincing case for some actions that might need to be taken, well, there would have to be a political will as also in order sometimes to make some of that happen.
Well, without talking about politics, the thing about politics is that can be guided, and just as we were talking about that short list of how we view science, by the public. The public really is the one who can determine how well things are. If we're getting into the same issues where the environment is deteriorated so bad that you don't have the fish to fish from, you don't have the mollusks, like whether clams or the oysters that you used to have, you can take actions that can slow it down, in some cases stop some of the input, and the system will recover if you don't keep threatening it, if you don't keep it on the edge. And that means not only the manatees, the sea turtles, the fish, the oysters, the water quality, and the people that live on it will all benefit. But we tend to, as a species, sometimes want to say, ooh, that's a lot of trouble, or that's a lot of money. But I think we're all smart enough to know that it's probably at a stage where we should take the recommendations of those scientists that are working with the Indian River Lagoon and work towards another approach. And that's what comes into understanding. If we first don't have a full understanding of how bad things are, then we're not going to take the actions necessary. So that's a bit of a problem, because you've got to get the word out to the general public. And everybody who feeds into this area needs to know what the problems are. And we need to work together beyond any kind of politics to get this thing back into a balance.
Oh, I sure hope so. Well, Dr. Walsh, we have to take a break, but we're going to come back and have more Animal Airwaves right after this. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Michael Walsh. We'll be back with more of the program in just a moment. Hi, welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Michael Walsh, and we're talking today about manatees. And earlier in the program, we were talking about an unusual mortality event that is underway and has been since late last year that has taken the lives of hundreds and hundreds of manatees, hundreds above normal in any given year. And this is alarming. And Dr. Walsh, let's talk a little bit more, if we can, about some of the other causes of mortality for manatees, because you sent me a bit of documentation here from, I guess, the FWC, the Florida's Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And there are many different causes of death listed as seen on a regular enough basis that they become a kind of documented sort of reason. And some of those are reasons that people listening to this program will be familiar with. Collisions with watercraft are unfortunately common.
Yes. And that may make up somewhere between 20 to 30%, depending on the year and depending on what's going on. The wonderful thing about that, and this is based on the effort of a lot of people, is that this was a very bad issue a number of years ago. You know, back when I first got into this field, there were thought to be only 2,000 manatees left instead of 7,000 to 8,000 or so now. And people were afraid they would literally go extinct. And if it weren't for the people from FWC, from Save the Manatee Club, from Fish and Wildlife Service, and a whole bunch of interested Floridians who wanted the manatee to survive, we would not have them in the state we have them now. So those things that a lot of people dislike terribly, like boat speeds and areas where you can't go as fast as you want, by dropping that component, that's helped the manatee to move ahead. Because as we're seeing with these unusual mortality events, the cold, another big thing that gets them besides those two is red tide, which is a very big problem on the West Coast. So you can have unusual mortality events in the past that were related to red tide, where hundreds and hundreds of animals died. In 2010, we had a severe cold season, and we lost many hundreds of animals that year as well. So Mother Nature, it builds in enough resilience to be able to take into account those wild contributors that hit us once in a while. But when we tip the scales with our boats and with our other human-related issues, with the state of where, let's say, a water body like the IRL is, we tip the scales beyond what Mother Nature might be able to handle. So we're no longer able to put things back into balance. If you have a bad cold year, yes, you lose a ton of manatees, but if there's nothing else that happens for years, their numbers can pop back up. And they don't pop back up. They can slowly reproduce to replace those individuals. The red tides have been devastating in some years, but the animals can recover as long as the red tide doesn't continue. And there is some thought that red tides are also influenced by human activity. They're a naturally occurring phenomenon, but if you feed those things, again, with nutrition, or if the salinity is different from what it should be because that organism does better at this salinity than the other, then you're making that a worse problem. And it's those human involvement issues where we produce cofactors that the manatee didn't evolve for that really push them over the edge.
Right, exactly. Now, those of us who were raised or have lived on the west coast of Florida, and I count myself as one of those, being from St. Petersburg, the red tides were something that you would hear about from time to time. But I think many of us maybe don't quite understand what a red tide is.
Well, red tide is the result of an organism called Karenia, which is basically one of those harmful algal bloom effects. And that organism is found naturally off the coast and in different areas. There's been some amazing work done with the FWC lab down in St. Pete to better understand this. And they monitor this on a regular basis. If you live down there at sometimes, especially Sarasota and below, you may have encountered it from the human perspective as a period of time when the organism is really high to where it'll be irritating to breathe it in, to be outside. It burns your eyes, it burns your respiratory system, and it actually does something similar at high levels to the manatee. But the manatee also eats the grasses. So as that organism comes in high numbers into the shallow areas where the manatee is, they're ingesting it, and it has a toxin related to it. So that the toxin first hits their nervous system, and they'll get to where they can't function in the water environment. They may not know which way's up. So if they don't get help to stay above the water, they may drown, they may inhale water and get secondary problems. If it's extremely severe, you'll actually get an effect directly on the respiratory system. And back in, gosh, I want to say it was maybe 15 years ago, there was a really high red tide to where there's actually hemorrhage in the respiratory system in the nasal cavity from so much toxin getting access to when they would breathe. So that's a very big factor in some years. And what seems to be different with the red tide effects is that they used to be very segmented in terms of how long they would last. And they started seeing a few years ago that the red tide would go on for many more months, which means much more exposure, which means many more deaths. So there's a lot of research going on now as to how do we mitigate or decrease the effects of what this organism is doing. How do we try to decrease the numbers. What are the factors that are helping it to grow? And if we don't control those, then you select for this to happen again and again, just like we have the harmful algal blooms. You'll hear them referred to as HABs, just for harmful algal bloom, happening on the East Coast more and more now. And that's where people got upset when their area turned into a green kind of soup. And that cuts out the sunlight, those organisms die, you lose the oxygen, and you get into those secondary problems. So as you're saying, we have to be cautious with these other factors that are known to kill animals, and that includes watercraft. Occasionally you get a couple of them being crushed or drowned in floodgates. You'll get other human-related things that can occur. Manatees get into pipes and culverts. They get entangled in ropes and lines and nets. Sometimes they ingest fishing gear and debris. Babies are always going to be another factor, a subgroup of the mortality groups that they're going to be challenged. Sometimes you've got a mom who's not good at raising the first time, and she doesn't do well, and the baby doesn't make it. Sometimes the baby gets separated. Sometimes the mom dies. Cold stress, other natural things like we're talking about, and those might include birth complications and natural catastrophes such as red tide. And then you'll get a certain subgroup of this that is just undetermined. The animal may have died weeks ago. It's been breaking down in the environment. When you try to do a necropsy or what would be an animal autopsy on them, their tissues are just so deteriorated you can't determine what happened. You may also get some that are verified dead, but they're not recovered, depending on when it happens and where it happens.
Yeah.
So this whole list every year is analyzed and looked at. And what's really thrown it out this year is this die-off. But there's also some red tide activity. So it could be those numbers could go up, which would be a shame when it's being hammered so bad on the East Coast.
And I'm looking at these numbers for this year so far. And as you mentioned, 696 dead animals so far. Now, on a given year, like, say, 2020, when there were 241 deaths in that year, well, only 64 animals were not necropsied. This year, 463 have not been necropsied. And that is for a variety of reasons, I'm sure, as you mentioned. But that poses the problem that it may be that many hundreds of these animals' cause of death will not be definitively determined. And what kind of challenges does that create in terms of helping finding ways to understand the problem?
Well, you're right. That is another factor that makes it more difficult to be able to fully analyze in detail what's happened. Part of that is a result of the pandemic. Because with the pandemic, not only do you shut down places like a restaurant or places where people gather, you also can't put people at risk by putting a large number of people into rooms where you would normally do the necropsy. So some of those necropsies were occurring out in the field. If you have so many animals dying in a short period of time, if you spread those animals out over 12 months, then you'd be dealing with a lower number of animals you have to deal with in terms of investigating each of those bodies. In this case, when you've got this many happening to where you're getting 200 a month, let's say, it's impossible to take a look at all of them. So you end up with the same situation that you might in a country where it's overrun with COVID. You physically can't get to all those bodies. And so you end up, in some cases, putting them somewhere out of sight where Mother Nature will end up helping them to break down, and you do as many as you can do in the middle of a pandemic. And I know that I'm sure the people at FWC are frustrated with this approach too, because it does impact things. But what they are seeing still overriding this is so many of these really, really thin animals, which still goes back to the food sources.
Yeah, I'm sure that they're doing all that they can to work this problem. Now, I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of conjecture, and as a scientist, you might not wish to do that, and I understand, but if you were to, say, look down the road to next year or the year after, where do you think we'll be?
I'm really not sure, and partially, as you say, because I'm not the person who's really evaluating the seagrasses, who's tied in totally to what's happening with any kind of restoration plans. I think what happens next year is difficult to predict, but if we don't start taking care of it now, then it'll be more than one next year. And I think that's how a lot of the scientists who are working with this are looking at it. No matter where it is now, time to engage and time to start approaching the problem so we don't have something that carries on for many, many years. So you would think, without going too much into the conjecture, that the odds are, unless the water quality really improves, there's not going to be enough seagrass when they come back next year. And then the question is, what happens the year after that? So what I think is happening at this stage, from what I'm hearing, is that the legislature is putting together funding to try to help the agencies that are involved in this and looking at some of the aspects that they might need to do. The seagrass restoration efforts probably will be kicking up somehow in terms of, can this type of seagrass that we're putting over here do well throughout the year? Can we protect it enough to let it get a foothold and grow before it could be wiped out by another following year of manatees who are looking for food? And realistically, you're probably fencing areas off to get it going to start with. You just can't potentially predict that you can get past the idea of hundreds coming back looking for more food.
Yeah. Well,
so I don't want to predict, but I think everybody feels that unless we make some changes right away and put the effort and the funding into it, things are going to get worse and not better.
Well, I will say this then, Dr. Walsh. Let's hope that if you and I talk next year at this time, we'll be talking about a much more normal sort of year, and some of these stresses on manatees will have been reduced, and we won't be looking at such shocking numbers of manatee deaths.
No, and I think it's really important that people understand that Fish and Wildlife Service, the manatee program there, FWC's manatee efforts, Save the Manatee Club, and the people that are in the restoration for the IRL, those are extremely important groups to support at this point so that we can really make progress on where we are and where we need to go.
Well, Dr. Michael Walsh from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me on.
I want to say thank you also to Sarah Carey at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine for her help with the program. And for listening to all of you, thank you so much. I'm Dana Hill. I hope you'll join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live.